Okay, let's get started. Our topic for tonight is the Americanization of the synagogue, and the important reference historiographically is Leon Jick's book titled The Americanization of the Synagogue, which was one of the most important works written in the field of American Jewish history. It was written in 1976, but it still maintains its significance 44 years later. Because of its groundbreaking research. So in the 1850s, traditional practice and belief was fading among American Jews. There was no doubt about it. Whereas people who had come off the boat from Central Europe might have had a degree of piety and firm conviction about what they would want in their religion, over time, as they spend more and more, their years in the United States, that firm conviction wanes, and they're willing to be more relaxed about their religious attitudes. But those Jews did not know what they wanted in their religious life. They were confused. Ideological reform had not yet made much headway. So people were clinging to group identity, and yet the urge of assimilation was very great. So these are simultaneous forces that are pulling people in different directions. Very few people are willing to make a complete break with their past. In other words, to commit apostasy and become a goy. But even fewer people are willing to adhere to the tradition completely. So there are almost no people converting out of the faith, but there are also almost no people really observing the faith in the proper fashion as would be expected of a traditionally Torah observant person. Everybody's somewhere in the middle and not with real ideological conviction about where they are. Just they happen to be there and they're on the move. But that move is progressively towards less and less religious observance. So the confusion manifested itself in a lot of funny ways in some of the synagogues. I'll give you a few examples. In St. Louis, at the United Hebrew Congregation, a committee was appointed to revise the prayers and to omit that which could be dispensed with. You know, those things we don't need to say anymore in the davening. While simultaneously, another committee was appointed to write a draft declaring that the synagogue desires to preserve the path of Orthodox Judaism and the religion of the fathers. So on the one hand, let's cut things out. On the other hand, the religion of the fathers. Well, what direction are they headed? They're not even sure. Rodev Shalom of Philadelphia passed defeated a motion to change the minhag of the synagogue. But why? Because they did not want to depart from the tradition of their ancestors. On the other hand, in the very same meeting, they decided we're going to abolish the sale of mitzvot, that we're not going to, you know, auction off the honors and the service as they had formerly done. So we don't want change. We're going to make a change. Anshe Chesed of New York struggled with the question of should the chazan face forward or should the chazan face the congregation? That's a relatively minor change, and yet they were agonizing over it. Well, a few days later, they decided to shorten the Tisha B'Av service and eliminate all the piyutim. So on the one hand, they're agonizing over a minor change and then acting upon a much more radical change. B'nai Yeshurun in Cincinnati brought their rabbi or their minister to a trial for hiring a Christian woman to serve as the cook in his house, and for doing shechita on his own poultry without a license to be a shochet. Now, these are not the worst of offenses, because bishul akum is a problem, but if the guy did shechita correctly, so he didn't have a license, but he did the shechita correctly. So they were all up in arms about that, and yet when he left the shul, a few months later, they hired Isaac Meir Wise, who's basically a shegetz, you know, doesn't believe in anything. Among the radical synagogues, there was Sinai of Chicago. And they were troubled by the fact that when they built their synagogue sanctuary, the seats faced north rather than east. Now, let me ask you a question. Why do we face east during davening? Why? Why?
Jerusalem,
right. So, but if you're of the viewpoint that the ingathering of the exiles, the kibbutz galiot and Shivat Zion is never going to happen because you've jettison that from your bag of ideological beliefs, well, what do you need to face east for? You don't. So since these people were a bunch of radicals who didn't believe in the messianic redemption, why is it such a problem that they face north? It's not. So why'd they worry about it? The answer is people were ignorant. They didn't realize why we do certain things that we do and why we might not do certain things anymore if we didn't believe in them anymore. It was all a hodgepodge. And to them, any one change might just rub them the wrong way. So facing north rather than facing east was to them, it's pastiche. You don't do that. Even though the underlying reason is something they no longer believed in. Okay. Now, Isaac Meyerowitz, the man I just mentioned, is not someone I admire in the historical record, but he's a very important person in 19th century Judaism, probably the most important person, so we have to talk about him again, as we've mentioned in past weeks. He was a bit of a phony, and he told people what they wanted to hear. So he told Benjamin Zold, I am Orthodox and Reform, neither and both at the same time, just like you. Meaning, I can float with the wind and go whichever way the wind is going, I can go in that direction. And by the way, you're the same thing. Now, but he didn't say it as a criticism to say, I'm a hypocrite and so are you, but rather, this is what my attitude towards religious life. And you should know I'm not the only one. You really are the same way. So at first, Wise enacted only minor changes in his synagogue in Cincinnati, the B'nai Yeshur Synagogue in Cincinnati. He eliminated some piyutim. They got rid of the Mishaberach and the sale of mitzvot. By the way, the getting rid of the Mishaberach was a big deal. People don't like the Mishaberach. You know why? Because you only like it when you're the one getting the Mishaberach. When it's your aliyah, good. So then put in 10 names. But you're only one of 100 people in the shul. When everybody else does it, you say, how come this is taking so long? So that's why people didn't like it. They wanted to get rid of it. What's the downside to getting rid of the Mishaberach? What's the downside?
You lose money.
Lose money, right. And the rabbis are in the religion business, and they have to make a parnasa. So they're not so quick to get fundraising tools. But if they can recoup their losses in some other way, by some other means of fundraising, then they would rather get rid of the Mishaberach. Okay. So Wise only had these minor changes. He insisted that the president and vice president of his synagogue close their businesses on Saturday. This was a lifelong pet peeve of Isaac Meyerowitz, that even though he departed from the traditional observance in many, many ways, and we're going to see a bunch of them tonight, still, Saturday Sabbath was a big deal to him. And how do you observe the Sabbath? You observe the Sabbath by not engaging. Your store should be closed. He wasn't makbid on Hilchos Borer, but you had to have your store closed. That minimally was the way you observe the Sabbath. Okay, so a few years later, an organ was introduced in his synagogue, and he had a mixed choir. Mixed gender choir. Sometimes mixed choir means Jews and Gentiles, but usually here in the 19th century, it means men and women. The Minhag America was his sitter, became the sitter that they used in his synagogue, which was a departure from the tradition. However, and listen to this one, everyone pay attention. On the high holidays, the traditional prayer book was used. Why? A visitor to the synagogue said perhaps they were afraid that God was awake on those days, and it would be worse for it in the God's judgment. When Hashem is paying attention, you better say the old davening. The rest of the year, you could daven like an apikoros, but on high holidays, you got to daven like a mensch. Okay. Now, Wise recognized that the real goal here was Americanization, and you have to make the religion fit the country. It can't fit the old world; it has to fit the new world. Ever since he had arrived in 1846, he had wanted a union of all the Jews in the country, whether in terms of liturgical uniformity or a synagogue union or a rabbinical union of the clergy or joint action for rabbinical education to ordain young people to become members of the clergy. He started two publications, as I mentioned in weeks past, The Israelite and Deborah in English and in German, to expand his empire, to build out his brand. It was a popular publication, unlike, for example, Isaac Leiser's The Occident, which was more highbrow and not for the Hamonam, the masses. So upwardly mobile American Jews in the 1850s and 60s were people that Wise wanted to attract. In 1855, he opened Zion College. I briefly mentioned this a couple of weeks back. And it was supposed to be a rabbinical seminary. As it turned out, it was just a high school for kids who didn't really know much. The Eastern congregations were angry with him because he was supposed to have arranged a deal with them whereby all the synagogues contributed money, and also, and the Eastern shuls as well, had some say over the runnings of this school. And he wasn't supposed to open the doors of the school until they agreed. He broke his promises, and in the fall of 1855, preempted everything and started the school. It was a failure. A year later, it was shut down. Wise reminisced 40 years afterward that American Jewry was not yet ripe for this kind of undertaking. Two decades later, it would be ripe for that undertaking, and we'll get to that tonight. In the 1870s, it would be time to start a school, and that school would be successful, and it still exists today, Hebrew Union College. Okay. So, in 1855, the Cleveland Conference of Jewish Ministers took place. And to make the traditionalists happy, Isaac Meir Wise conceded the point to Isaac Leiser that the Bible and the Talmud are the basis for Judaism. Leiser was criticized viciously by Morris Raphael of New York for cooperating with reformers. Now, this is a very important question. To what extent should an Orthodox clergy person be willing to sit down to discuss theological issues with people who are openly reformed? It's a question that exists ad hayom hazeh, till this very day. Can you participate in mixed denomination boards of rabbis? So there are those who are fiery against it, say, oh, it's a terrible thing, and there are those who are more relaxed in their attitude towards it.
South Africa?
What was that?
Yes.
Okay, so.
In South Africa, it would never happen.
It would never happen, correct. So there are a bunch of places in the world where it would never happen because the denominational divide is so sharp and the regard of the Orthodox for the less Orthodox is with utter disdain. And so you simply can't have that kind of cooperation. Okay. Now, but putting aside theological issues, the prestigious old line Eastern Seaboard congregations were reluctant to give any institutional authority to guys in the Midwest, to the greenhorns, to the guys from Yokeldom, the guys from Yehovitzville. That here you have Spanish Portuguese and established German congregations in cities like New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, etc., who think to themselves, listen, we are the bosses of American Judaism. Who's this clown from Cincinnati trying to establish some kind of a hierarchy and put himself at the top? He's a nobody, and therefore we recognize him as such. So there was an East-West rivalry that actually overshadowed whatever theological differences might have existed and did exist between the various participants. Now, partly in response to Wise's efforts at Cleveland, the guys in the East established in 1859 the Board of Delegates of American Israelites. We'll discuss that in another about 10, 15 minutes, the proximate cause for the creation of that body. But when they did so, Wise, he lashed out at them and said they are the discredited aristocracy, that they think they're so high and mighty, that they've been running American Judaism for so long. Well, they're not in charge anymore. They've been discredited. Were they? We'll see, maybe, because in the end, Wise wins. Okay. Now, the biggest detractor that Wise had and that the Cleveland Conference had was that of David Einhorn. So I mentioned David Einhorn in past weeks, but I want to emphasize his theological perspective and why he was such a fiery opponent of everybody else. So Wise recently arrived from Europe in 1855 and went to Baltimore. And he was angry with the reformers for capitulating to the traditionalists at Cleveland, meaning that why did you agree that the Bible and Talmud is the basis of Judaism? You shouldn't have. Well, if the Bible and Talmud is not the basis of Judaism, then what is the basis of Judaism? I ask you. Anybody have an idea?
Feelings in your heart.
All right, feelings in your heart. You're onto something there. So basically it's going to be natural morality as we come to it of our own intellectual endeavors, not from a defining received tradition or a revelation. So Einhorn said, we appreciate peace in Israel as a precious boon. In other words, Shalom al Yisrael is important. It's important. However, a peace which necessarily degrades Judaism appears to us too dearly bought, like it's a Faustian deal. You know, you gave too much to get too little. And may the free American Israel keep a strict watch on hierarchical movements, which would forge us in chains under the most charming lullabies of peace. So here, Einhorn is saying, we don't want to be put in chains of an ecclesiastical hierarchy. Why is he so worried about that? So the answer is very simple. He's new to America. He thinks of America as a great place precisely because America has separation of church and state, and religion is a totally volitional matter, and we are free to associate religiously with whomever we want, and no one can boss us around. He came from Europe where that wasn't true. He was the rabbi in Mecklenburg-Schwerin, and then he became the rabbi in 1851 in Pest. Pest as in Budapest, but before the city was joined, when it was Buda and it was Pest. So he was the rabbi in the radical congregation in Pest, and the Hungarian government shut him down after like 3 months. And for the next 4 years, he was out of a job. That throughout the early 1850s, Einhorn was a recognized scholar and radical maverick reformer, but a guy who didn't have Parnassa because in Europe, the government, the kings and the princes still controlled what was legal religion and what wasn't. So he was very happy to come to America where now he had freedom to operate. And he didn't want that freedom in any way impinged upon by some other Jewish clergy gathering together in some kind of a cabal. Okay. So Einhorn called them so-called reformers. He noted that reform was much more than excising a paragraph or two from the sitter. He mocked them as bacon reformers. You like that? Bacon reformers. Bacon. They, in his view, they thought that you're a good reform rabbi or reform Jew if you throw away chunks of the tree of Judaism. You chop off branches from the tree of practical Judaism. You eat treif instead of kosher. You daven less instead of davening more. So they think that's what makes you a real reformer. Whereas Einhorn is of the view, no. Those are just the outward manifestations of reform. But the essence of reform is ideological change. And, the thinking behind it, the philosophizing. Well, Wise reacted with real virulence towards Einhorn. He called him a deist, a Unitarian, a Tzeduki, a Sadducee, apostle of deistic rationalism. So whatever highfalutin terms you could come up with in the 19th century for a Jew who doesn't believe anymore, that's what Wise hurled at Einhorn and said, the guy doesn't believe anything. Well, he also said, he got personally said, Einhorn, you forgot that your father was a Jew. That's a real dirty comment to make. You forgot that your father was a Jew. He called Einhorn the enemy of Jews and Judaism. Now, the truth is, Einhorn didn't have much of a following. Even Temple Emmanuel, which was the most radical of all the Reform synagogues at that point, did not use Einhorn's prayer book. They used their own, which was made by their Rabbi Merzbacher. And even in Einhorn's own shul, Knesset Israel in Philadelphia, they didn't always follow what he wanted them to do. They abolished the second day of Yontif in 1864, but only 3 years after he got there. Isaac Meir Wise had abolished the second day of Yontif 5 years earlier in 1859. So in some ways, Einhorn was a failure in the realm of practical rabbinics, of getting his people to follow what he thought was the right thing to do. He wanted to preach in German. But the board of the shul, they said, no, you have to preach in English. Why did he want to preach in German? It wasn't just because his English was less than satisfactory. You know, as a newcomer, he needed to learn the language and polish his skills in English. It wasn't just that. He really believed that the Sprach, the language of reform, is the German language. Something doesn't sit well with me about that. I mean, we live after the Holocaust, so the German language has a negative connotation in our minds. But in the 19th century, the Reform rabbis, at least some of the more ideological purists, they believe that German was the language of Reform Judaism. Okay, so the Board of Delegates of American Israelites, I mentioned, was established in 1859 by the Eastern congregations. It was established in response to the Mortara affair, the kidnapping of a Jewish child in Italy and the forced conversion to Catholicism, just as the Board of Deputies of British Jews had been established in 1840 in response to the Damascus blood libel. But not everyone wanted to participate in this Board of Delegates. It was an Eastern phenomenon only. There were 24 synagogues, 11 of them were in New York City, 13 of them were elsewhere, but of the 24, only one was west of the Alleghenies in New Orleans. The Westerners wanted nothing to do with it, because I said there's this east-west divide, like, you know, the rap wars in the 1990s. So the Spanish Portuguese and some of the reformers also didn't want to join in. Sheriff Israel of New York, Mikveh Israel of Philly, and Emmanuel of New York did not join in. Why? So the answer is there was still an element of Spanish Portuguese snobbishness where they thought they were better than everybody else. You know, elitism that goes back to the colonial period. And Emmanuel, as a reform synagogue, did not want this board of delegates functioning as a religious hierarchy that could prevent the spread of reform. Meaning, if it really was a religious union as opposed to just a union of ethnic kinsmen, then they might start issuing edicts about, you know, what's a kosher synagogue and what's not a kosher synagogue. And Emmanuel didn't want to have anything to do with that, lest they run foul of somebody else's rulings. So this board of delegates, it didn't catch on the way that its founders wanted it to. Isaac Leeser wanted this board of delegates to be a very robust organization that would get involved in the training of rabbis, establish a Beit Din, involved in publications of Siddur and Chumash, to do all sorts of things that he himself had been doing throughout his career as a lone wolf. You know, Isaac Leeser did a lot of great things, but he operated in, as an individual lone operator. He wanted a union of some kind representing many of the synagogues of the United States to fund and help facilitate all these good things. In the end, the board of delegates adopted a much narrower focus. And I want to read to you the 5 points that they adopted for their agenda. Let me read to you. Point number one, to obtain and collect all possible statistics, information respecting the Israelites of America, and have same duly arranged for easy reference. In other words, we want to know how many Jews live in America, how many synagogues there are in America, how many schools there are in America, all the data that we now are accustomed to having, because whether it's the American Jewish Committee or whatever nonprofit is out there that does the social research about the American Jewish community, so none of that existed in the old days. And people were just guesstimating how many Jews there were and how many Jewish institutions there were. So the Board of Delegates is saying, we want real hard data to help us understand our community and to serve it better. So this is not a very controversial point. It's a very good idea. Number two, to appoint a committee of arbitration for the purpose of settling disputes, which may arise between congregations belonging to the union and between individuals and public bodies on congregational matters, with a view of preventing a resort to law, as an objective of this committee is to be simply the preservation of peace. Nothing further than offering advice is contemplated. In other words, people go to court, secular court. The rabbi sues the shul. The shul sues the rabbi. The membership sues the shul. Different factions fight over whether it's an Orthodox or Reform, and they go to the local magistrate for adjudication. Well, Talmudically, is that kosher?
No.
It's in.
It's a violation of Arkaot Shel Akum. It's a Talmudic concept that we don't go to the Goyish courts to resolve internal Jewish matters.
Yeah.
And so in 1859, there was an awareness that several synagogues had already gone to secular courts, dating back as early as Charleston in 1824. Remember the Charleston experiment, the Congregation Beit Elohim. Yes. So that's not good. That's an embarrassment for the community. If we could have some neutral arbitrating body that could decide these things or at least give guidance, maybe we'd embarrass ourselves a little bit less. So it's a nice idea. Now, point number three. To promote religious education, first by encouraging local schools and the congregations belonging to the board, second by establishing a high school for the training of young men so as to qualify them to become ministers and teachers. So the first point is Jewish education, chinuch, in the synagogues, that it was assumed, where was your kid going to get Jewish education? Not in a parochial school that exists on its own, but rather in some kind of after school setting, or maybe even in a day school setting, but one which is attached to the synagogues. It's no longer the case that most day schools are organizationally attached to synagogues. It happens in some places, but on the whole, we don't do that anymore. But back then, that was the working assumption. Then the second business of the high school, there was an awareness that you can't import rabbis forever. Eventually, a Jewish community of substantial size has to be able to graduate its own clergymen. Well, where is that going to happen? There's no institution to accomplish that. Zion College was a failure. So we need something going forward to ordain ministers. Now, notice it doesn't say rabbis. It says ministers and teachers. Because I guess there was an awareness that smicha in the traditional sense is too far of a reach. You know, tafasta meruba, lo tafasta. You try to grab too much, you get nothing. You get nothing. So David Simrod is asking, was this like a Talmud Torah? Yeah, so they wanted Talmud Torahs for the synagogues, and they wanted a higher level to graduate teachers and maybe even ministers. Then number four, to keep a watchful eye on occurrences at home and abroad and see that the civil and religious rights of Israelites are not encroached upon and call attention to proper authorities to the facts should any violation occur. Meaning, you have to defend Jewish rights. If some government, whether domestically, some state or the federal government, does something which runs afoul of our legitimate rights, we're going to have to raise a ruckus and try to remedy the situation. Or if it happens abroad, that American Jewry will be actively involved in defending the rights of Jews in other countries where they are a beleaguered minority and are pushed around. So specifically, aside from the Mortara affair of 1858-1859, there was another incident involving Switzerland in 1857 that the Swiss cantons distinguished between Christians and Jews. The Jews did not have full rights and had very severe economic limitations on them. Well, what happens when an American Jew who is a citizen of the United States goes to Switzerland and tries to conduct business? Is the Swiss government going to identify this person as a Yid, as a Jew, or as an American citizen? So we, as American Jews and as passport holders, would like to believe that whatever is the attitude of a given government towards American citizens generally shall be that government's attitude towards us too, because our religious identity is immaterial. The only thing that matters is our American passport. So sadly, that wasn't always the case in the real world. There were countries in Europe and elsewhere that applied the domestic discriminatory policy towards Jews of foreign citizenry, foreign citizenship. And so that was a big deal to fight back against. Okay. The same thing would happen with Russia in the early part of the 20th century in terms of American trade relations with Tsarist Russia. Number five. So the fifth and final point of the Board of Delegates was to keep up communication with similar Central Israelitish bodies throughout the world and, in fine, to establish a thorough union among all Israelites in the United States. So, yeah, the business of establishing a union of all Israelites in the U.S., granted, they want to grow this body to include all American Jews. But the first part is communication with similar bodies around the world. Well, what other bodies are there around the world? So there's the Board of deputies of British Jews. So that's in England. But there's also the Alliance Israelite Universelle, which is established the next year, 1860, in France, but was already in the works in 1859. So Western countries that have sizable Jewish populations seem to be creating these kinds of organizations that are supposed to be all-encompassing. In Germany, it would be the Central Verein, which we spoke about in years past. So yes, you have these catch-all groups, umbrella groups, that should cooperate with each other. It's in the best interest of world Jewry if these various groups are on the same page. Okay, so this is the agenda that the Board of Delegates had. But while it was useful during the Civil War in fighting General Order Number 11, as we spoke about, and in the chaplaincy issue, which we spoke about, the Board of Delegates faded into an insignificance after the Civil War. It never had the support of the majority of German Jewish communities in the United States. And by 1878, it was subsumed under the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, which we'll talk about how that was established in 1873, and it became the Board of Delegates on Civil and Religious Rights. So basically, the Eastern congregations formed their union. It lasted for a few years, in reality, then another decade on paper, and then was taken over in a hostile takeover by the Western Union, not the the telegram company, but the Western Union of Jews, a decade and a half later. Okay. Now, in 1861, there were about 200 synagogues in America. About 200 synagogues.
According
to Leon Jick, only 8 could really be called Reform synagogues. Of course, it all depends upon how you want to define a Reform synagogue. How many innovations or departures from tradition do you have to undertake before Mr. Jick or Professor Jick of Brandeis is willing to say that you're a Reform synagogue? Writing in 1976 about what happened 110 years earlier. So it's a subjective thing when you declare something to be Reform. But in his view, in 1861, the vast, vast, vast majority were not yet identifiably Reform. However, and why is that the case? Because they davened with their heads covered, and most of the davening was in Hebrew. But the direction was clear. We're moving away from tradition. So that by 1870, according to Jick, nearly all synagogues had moved dramatically in the direction of Reform. Very few held out. Even the old line Sephardic synagogue started to permit deviations from tradition. Now, some of them maintain their status as Orthodox shuls. So, for example, Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik today is the rabbi of Sherith Israel. It's an Orthodox shul, but not all of them ended up in the same place. Some, even of the old line synagogues, went along the path of heterodoxy. So, the question that we have to ask ourselves is, why did this happen in the 1860s? Why was that a significant decade for a dramatic move, we might say, to the left, away from religious tradition? So, a few reasons. First of all, there was a decline in immigration, which meant that the ranks of traditionalists were not reinforced. Also, nationalistic fervor from the Civil War meant that you wanted to Americanize every aspect of your life, including your religious life. Also, the wartime experience changed people at the individual level. You know, you weren't the same person at the end of the war you were at the beginning of the war. We're going to see this is true, especially for World War II. In a few months from now, when we discuss GI Jews, the Jewish experience in World War II, we'll see that going through combat and being away from home, being away from Yiddishkeit, changes you even when you get back. Okay. So, also, there was a homogeneity to the community in the 1860s that had not existed since the 1820s. It will be upended in the 1870s and 1880s with the arrival of Eastern European Jews, but at least for a little while, the community is looking more and more homogenous. Post-war economic opportunities meant that people got very rich. But you'll tell me there was a recession after the war. You're right, there was one. But individuals who were involved in industrialization had to make their fortune. And so every large and mid-sized city in the United States by the late 1860s, early 1870s, had its cadre of wealthy German Jewish Americans. And what are these people going to do? Well, they're going to build big cathedral synagogues. That's what they're going to do. It was a time when everyone believed in progress. Progress. What is progress? So Darwinism and biblical criticism were on the rise. The Free Religious Association, led by Ralph Waldo Emerson, was popular. And even rabbis, including Wise and Lilienthal, got in on the act. So the days of dogmatic traditionalism and sticking to the catechism were over. Now everybody's loosey-goosey with what they believe in. Whereas a decade before, the Reform rabbis are worried about piyutim and chalitza, now they're thinking about solving the problems of all of mankind. And Wise predicted, laughably, that in 25 years, all of America will be Reformed Jews. How do you like that? I didn't say all of American Jews will be Reformed Jews. He says all of America will be Reformed Jews. It was laughable, but he meant it. No. I said they build big cathedral synagogues. How much do they spend? And where are they doing this? So Temple Emmanuel, in 1868, builds a big building on 5th Avenue and 43rd Street. By the way, what shul is there now? Chabad of Midtown.
Oh, Chabad.
Chabad of Midtown replaced Temple Emmanuel, yes.
Oh. So
they paid $750,000 to build a huge cathedral synagogue, which didn't last very long because they would move uptown to 65th Street in the 1920s. And in 1862, there was only one synagogue north of 28th Street. By 1865, there were nine. Now, that has to do with the history of the city of New York, which I'm not going to go to in any great detail, of course, but if you want to read about the history of the city of New York, yeah. I suggest you buy on Amazon Moses Rishon's book on the Jewish community of New York. It's a worthwhile read. It goes through geographically where the synagogues moved, you know, from downtown to uptown. In Cincinnati, the Plum Street Temple was Bei Yeshurun, was Isaac Meir Wise's synagogue, was built in 1866 for $250,000, and it seated 2,000 people, a huge cathedral synagogue. In Philadelphia, Rodev Shalom built a huge synagogue for $200,000. They begin to use the word temple for these big buildings. So whereas in Germany, the word temple was already being used in 1810 at Seeson with Israel Jacobson's temple at the very beginnings of the Reform movement, in America, the word is basically only used once you get to the 1860s and the big, big buildings. What does a temple mean as opposed to a synagogue? So in the view of the reformers, it means going from perpetual mourning to gladness. The synagogue is perpetual mourning, avelus, gladness, yagon l'simcha, me'eva l'yom tov, ostracism to brotherhood, from darkness to light, me'afela l'or gadol. Right out of the Seder. Okay. So the change in doctrine was hardly noted by anybody at this time. The main thing was the externals and the extravagance of the whole thing. Very few people are worried about how we justify this on doctrinal terms. Even the relatively traditional synagogues, like B'nai Yeshurun in Manhattan, began to make changes. So B'nai Yeshurun under Morris Raphael had been an Orthodox synagogue. But after he died in 1868, they moved the reader's desk from the middle of the shul to the front of the shul. Then they abolished the kittel except for the clergy. Interesting. They abolished the kittel for the laity, but not for the clergy. They adopted mixed pews, an organ, a mixed gender choir. And by 1878, they joined the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. Wow. And it turned out B'nai Yeshurun did not go all the way in the camp of reform. How do we know that? Well, today, B'nai Yeshurun is a big conservative shul, the Upper West Side of Manhattan. How did that happen? So the answer is that sometimes it's just the luck of the draw, that the next rabbi they hired after that was of a more traditional bent, and he veered the synagogue towards the middle ground of the historical school of the conservative movement. So sometimes you just get, you know, you get lucky one way or the other. Okay. Now, Temple Emmanuel, you know, the granddaddy of reform synagogues, they were wearing yarmulkes or hats as late as 1859. But after a vigorous debate, they decided, you know what? Let's make it optional. Let's make it optional. In 1864, they realized that was a bad idea. We should not have made it optional because having diversity of practice ruins the decorum. It's like on Chol HaMoed, half the shul wears tefillin and half the shul doesn't wear tefillin. And the rabbi gets up and says, "Oh, Gavalt, you can't have this lotus go to do. You can't have a mixed situation. Everybody's got to do one or the other. So either everyone's going to wear a hat or everyone's going to not wear a hat." And what do they decide? Progress. Take off your yarmulkes. All right? Everybody, goodbye to the hats. And by the way, that became the policy in most places, that it was no longer the discretion of the individual parishioner, but rather it was a hard and fast rule that you had to take off your hat. In my family's tradition or historical memory, it's of my grandparents being in Boston in 1943 for Yom Kippur, where my grandfather was a quartermaster sergeant at the Boston Port of Embarkation in the Army during the war, and they lived on Beacon Street near the Cheers Tavern, and they walked down Harvard Street to get towards Brookline, and they got to the big Reform synagogue, and what happened? They walk in and they ask my grandfather to take off his hat, and he thinks this is very odd. And then he hears, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts!" And they looked at each other. My grandmother, my grandfather said, "We're out of here," and they walked home. Little did they realize it was a more traditional shul, another block down, and they could have walked a little further. They would have gone to shul, but so it goes. So take off that hat. That was the policy starting in the 1860s and continued really until the 1970s. when Reform synagogues began to relax their attitude and have a tolerance for yarmulkes. Today, most Reform rabbis wear yarmulkes, and with good reason, because otherwise they're indistinguishable from anybody else. You have to have some clerical garb or outfit, and the yarmulke serves that purpose.
In Sharit Israel,
yeah,
they have a collection of hats for those who call and do not have a hat. And,
oh, yeah?
And the officers wear top hats.
All right, so that's part of the old aristocratic tradition. Yeah. Okay, so this change of the no yarmulke was identified by some scholars of American Jewish history, notably Jick and others, as being a real significant shift. It made the Jewish worship look Christian. It made it look Jewish. Not that halachically the yarmulke is the most important thing. In the grand scheme of things, halachically, the yarmulke is on the low end of the scale. But we're not talking about halacha here. We're talking about what people think and what people feel. And it just looks bad from a traditionalist vantage point to not have a hat, a head covering during davening. Okay, so Isaac Meir Wise, ever the phony, sees what direction things are headed in. He sees what's happening in Emmanuel at Sinai of Chicago. And in his shul in 1871, he said, you have to wear a head covering. In 1872, he said, well, you can go either way. In 1874, he said, no head coverings. In 1875, he said, we're not going to allow a head covering. All right, so he went with the times. I mentioned that in certain synagogues, they were confused about what they wanted. You know, this process of Americanization, it didn't have a clear beginning or a clear end. And the lay people, without much guidance, were struggling in the dark, groping in the dark for a solution. So in Fort Wayne, Indiana, in 1859, they voted to preserve the Orthodox ways. By 1863, they voted to wear shoes on Yom Kippur. What's wrong with wearing shoes on Yom Kippur? It's also, you're not allowed to. And no shaking of the lulav, and let's use the David Einhorn prayer book. So in 4 years, they went from we're going to be Orthodox to we're going to use a prayer book of a radical reformer. In Akron, Ohio, listen to this one. In Akron, they voted in 1865 to adopt the Minhag America. How do you spell Minhag? M-I-N-H-A-G. Well, they didn't know what that word was. So they spelled it in English, M-I-N-N-I-C-K. They literally didn't know what the word Minhag was. They thought it was Minhag. So they voted, we're going to adopt Minhag America. A month later, there's a note in the board in the minutes of the board meeting that the secretary of the shul should investigate what Minhag America actually is. They didn't even know what they voted on. They were so ignorant, they didn't know what they voted on. And when they found out what it was, they said, no, we don't want that. But 6 months after that, they said, you know, we do want it. So they have no clue what they want. In eastern cities, were there many breakaway shuls? Len is asking. The answer is absolutely yes. Breakaway shuls are a common phenomenon already from the 1820s. Well, in Philadelphia, already from 1800. But in New York from the 1825, in Baltimore from 1830. And once you have a second shul, it's very easy to have a third or fourth or fifth. And usually these synagogues break away along the lines of minhag, of liturgical rite, of Poland versus Germany versus Moravia. So you have multiple Ashkenazic varieties of the liturgy, and each one wants their own ethnic version of the liturgy. Later on, you'll have breakaways on the basis of you're not frum enough or you're too frum, religious piety being an issue. Okay. Now, synagogues began to compete for big name clergy. Now, everybody wants a prestigious rabbi. So they did this in part because the neighboring Protestants were doing the same thing. As the Goyim do, so the Jews do. The Protestants were hiring big name preachers for thousands of dollars annual salary. The Jews will do the same thing. So who got hired? Well, in 1857, Samuel Adler came from Germany to Temple Emmanuel. Benjamin Zold came from Europe to Baltimore. Marcus Jastrow came to Philadelphia. Samuel Hirsch came from Europe to Philadelphia. Kaufman Kohler came from Europe to go to Detroit. So in a span of a few years, some big name rabbis of a progressive variety came to these shores and occupied major pulpits. Now, unlike the ones who came in the 1840s, who usually got fired and didn't have much success, the ones who came a little bit later had prestige and had something of an illustrious careers. Okay.
So, was it the same with the cantors?
The thing with the cantors, that happens in the 1890s and 1900s, where Chazanut is a big deal in the Lower East Side and in the other Eastern European sort of ethnic enclave communities. And so Chazanim would be hired for top dollar to daven on the Nevarchim Chodesh, to daven on the High Holidays, Yom Tovim. And usually they would not have a regular pulpit, like they were the Chazan of this shul, but rather they were like a hired goon that they'd come and they'd go and they'd get their money. Well, I discussed this at some length years ago. Who remembers? I discussed about Woodward Street Synagogue and other Lower East Side synagogues that were large, big places. They wanted to impress the audience that afford a big name chazan, and this was to try to keep the young people involved in the synagogue. That if you'd have a prestigious cantor, the young people would be interested in coming to shul, as opposed to going to the shtiebel and moving away uptown. It didn't really work. Just those who liked chazanus and enjoyed it for a little while.
How about the introduction of choirs? Is that an issue if you do not have musical accompaniment?
So the introduction of the choir is important in this time, in the 1860s and 1870s, in the synagogues that are going the non-traditional route, because the choir is a way for the congregants to be passive. You know, the congregants that don't know much by religious knowledge, they're Judaically ignorant, but they're going to go to shul. If they have to rely upon their own davening to get through the service, they're not going to get through the service. By having the clergy, the rabbi give the speech, and the cantor and choir conduct the liturgy, so that is much more palatable to the Jew who doesn't know all that much. And
was there an element of entertainment?
Of course, absolutely, absolutely. Entertainment should not be ignored. It was a big deal. People wanted to spend the hour or two enjoying themselves. They did not want to be bored. Boredom is the death knell of synagogue life. So if you have the rabbi giving an edifying sermon and really impressing people with his oratorical skills, and the choir and cantor sound nice, who wouldn't go? Who wouldn't want to go? Okay. So one of the things that the synagogue boards insisted upon was that these rabbis preach in English. They have the language skills at first, and they acquire those skills, and sometimes it would take them a few years. But the main thing is, whereas the older generation understood German, and maybe even the younger generation understood some German, the synagogue is going the route of English. German has to disappear in the long run. Samuel Adler and David Einhorn, the rabbi of Beth El in New York and the rabbi of Emmanuel of New York, they got together to organize the Emmanuel Theological Seminary Association in the late 1860s, early 1870s. So was there ever an Emmanuel Theological Seminary? On 65th Street and 5th Avenue, is there a smicha place? No. So there never was such a school. It was an association, which means you contribute money. So there's a pot of money in a bank account somewhere governed by Emmanuel and Bethel that is supposed to go for the purpose of educating people in the rabbinate. Well, everybody knows America has to produce its own rabbis eventually, but there's no school to do so. Granted, Leiser established Maimonides College in 1867, but it died a year or two later. It was not a success. So where are you going to send these boys if you want to ordain them as ministers? The answer is you send them back to Europe. Europe has rabbinical training facilities. Where in Europe? So at Berlin, you have the Hochschule, which is Reform, under Abraham Geiger. And at Breslau, you have the Jewish Theological Seminary, the JTS, which is positive historical or middle of the road. So this Emmanuel Theological Seminary Association only sent people abroad for training, nothing locally. The two most important people they sent abroad did not become Reform rabbis. There's a certain irony here. What's the irony? The two guys who they sent were Felix Adler and Bernard Drachman. Now, who knows a little bit of something about either of those two men, Felix Adler and Bernard Drachman?
Bernard Drachman was very active in establishing laws to protect Sabbath observers.
Correct. That's right. That's right. Okay. So Bernard Drachman went to JTS in Breslau. He was born in Newark. He was American born, went to Europe, and was ordained by JTS of Breslau, but became an Orthodox rabbi. He married a member of the Weil family, Ephraim Weil's daughter, and because he couldn't get a pulpit because he was too religious, and the shuls that had no mechitza, he wouldn't serve there, so his rich father-in-law built a shul for him. They built a shul at 163 East 67th Street, otherwise known as what?
Park
East Synagogue, right. Congregation Zichron Ephraim, who was named after Ephraim Weil. Okay. And Rabbi Steyer changed the name in 1965 to Park East Synagogue. Okay, so here, a guy...
Oh, you did not change it to Arthur Schneier Synagogue?
Yeah. So someone who went to school on the scholarship of a Reform Emmanuel became the founder of Zichron Ephraim and Orthodox Shul. Now, the other one was Felix Adler. So Felix Adler was the son of Samuel Adler. Samuel Adler was the rabbi of Emmanuel. Well, what happens when you're the rabbi of a prestigious shul and your son gets smicha? What happens to the son?
He wrote an Orthodox prayer book.
Okay, so if you're a rabbi of a prestigious shul and your son gets smicha, what inevitably happens? Your son becomes?
An assistant rabbi.
The assistant rabbi. And then when you're ready to retire, what happens?
He becomes a rabbi.
Okay, it's standard practice. But what happened? There was a little bit of a glitch in the system. Felix Adler went to Europe, became an atheist. So he got ordained from the Hochschule, came back to New York for his first sermon from the pulpit as the assistant rabbi of Emmanuel in 1876. He announces, "Sorry, folks, but I can't be a rabbi. And why can't I be a rabbi? Because I can't even be a Jew, because I don't believe anymore." So what does he do? He establishes the Ethical Culture Society. Culture Society, which today is on the Upper West Side, not far from Spanish Portuguese Synagogue, from Sherith Israel. So that was a club where, you know, high-minded people could gather and discuss being virtuous, but without theological beliefs or without denominational beliefs. Let me ask you, what kind of people joined Ethical Culture?
Reform Jews.
Right. It took more courage to be a goy, to join Ethical Culture, to hang out with Jews, than it took for a Jew who doesn't believe anyway, to instead of going to Reform Shul, go to Ethical Culture Shul. That it was basically a hangout for disbelieving Jews with a handful of Gentiles mixed in.
They're also progressive in their social outlook.
Oh, correct. So their main thing was progressive politics.
Yes.
Tikkun Olam, before the term Tikkun Olam, was a big deal. All right. Well, in 1869, there was a conference in Philadelphia convened by David Einhorn. Now remember, Einhorn, he's the ideologue, and he doesn't like when reform is done in a haphazard fashion by just chopping off branches of the tree of Judaism. He wants it to be mesudar, that it has to be that for a good reason we chop off the branches of the tree of Judaism. So the Philadelphia conference issued a manifesto, which was pretty radical. It said no Messiah, no restoration of the sacrifices, no return to Zion, universal human brotherhood, vernacular worship. Of course, the irony is it said vernacular worship, and this manifesto was written in German. So English prayer, but the rabbis don't know English. They speak German. Okay. In the viewpoint of Leon Jick and some scholars, this platform had no impact whatsoever because the reforms were moving forward at a practical level since the laity wanted it. It was from the ground up. And that rabbinic philosophizing didn't really matter. Others, however, have a different historical assessment and say the rabbis did matter and their philosophizing did have a role to play in the trajectory of reform. All right, so it's a historical debate as to what, you know, what we should emphasize. Isaac Mayer Wise did not like the idea that the guys in the East Coast had a meeting and decided things and he wasn't in charge. So in 1871, he calls for a meeting in Cincinnati. And he wants this meeting not to be about philosophizing, but about practical action. So let me read to you from the 1871 meeting what he wanted to accomplish. Okay, quote. To unite themselves into a Hebrew congregational union with the object to preserve and advance the union of Israel, to take proper care of the development and promulgation of Judaism, to establish and support a scholastic institute for the education of rabbis, preachers, and teachers of religion, provide cheap editions of the English Bible textbooks to schools and religious instruction, to give support to the weak congregations, and to provide such other institutions which elevate, preserve, and promulgate Judaism. Ah, that's a nice thing. So basically a union with the financial resources to run a school and to run publications and to help synagogues that are struggling. All very nice. All very, very nice. So what's going to happen? Well, 2 years later, in 1873, 34 synagogues send representatives to Cincinnati to establish the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. This was not supposed to be a denominational institution. It was rather supposed to be ideologically vague so as to incorporate as many different shades of Judaism as possible. At first, there were no Eastern synagogues. It was all Midwestern and Southern. But within a few years, the Easterners joined too. Of the East realized that it was time to get together, that the rabbis of the East had petty grievances against the wives and the guys in the West, and it was time to get past that. In any event, there was no longer a condescending attitude by rich Easterners towards the Midwestern upstarts, because the Midwesterners were rich too, that the economy had improved, and there was no longer this gap in terms of social class and standing between East and West. Okay. The Union of American Hebrew Congregations established the school, the Hebrew Union College, for training of rabbis in 1875. Wise was the president of the school for the rest of his life, from 1875 to 1900. He referred to it as an Orthodox school. Baloney, it wasn't. But it also wasn't absolutely reform either. He wanted people to think it was anywhere on the map that they wanted it to be, because he needed supporters, financial supporters, and he needed students that would come and learn so that he could graduate rabbis to be his disciples. So what he did was very smart. He invited the traditionalist rabbis, not the super ortho rabbis, but rather the middle of the road rabbis, you know, the conservative types, to come to Cincinnati to serve as examiners when the kids were taking their smicha tests, you know, like the bochein we have in the yeshiva. So he invited these moderate rabbis, come to Cincinnati, I'll pay your train ticket, and you'll ask questions of the boys, and you'll see that they're learning really well. They give a faher. And this worked. It was able to convince people who were not rabid reformers that HUC was a worthy institution. However, it all came to an end on July 11th, 1883, when what happened?
They had a Trefa conference or something?
Good, the Trefa banquet. So the Trefa banquet has gone down in history as being one of the turning points in, you know, in American Jewish life. My birthday, July 11th, but 19. They served Trefa at the graduation ceremony of the first smicha class of HUC. They served frog's legs and non-kosher beef and snails and ice cream to boot, so basa b'chalav and tarfus.
Everything.
Terrible. Now, Wise actually didn't intend for the treif to be served. It was like a little bit of a foul-up with the caterer. It wasn't the kosher caterer, but Wise wasn't expecting the egregious nature of the violations of kashrus. Like, it was so over the top of what they were serving. The only thing they didn't serve was pork, but every other manifestation of non-kosher was there on the menu. So Wise, certain people in this life don't like to ever admit they're wrong. They double down when you catch them in a lie or in the corner. And so what did Wise do? He made fun of kitchen Judaism, stomach Judaism, gustatory Judaism. That's a great expression, gustatory Judaism. Uh-huh. Keep kosher. Kosher is for like the old-fashioned types. Come on, folks. We can eat treif, it's no big deal.
Is it anything more to expect being in the Midwest after all? You know, it's given the times and the isolation of Jews in the Midwest.
You're right that in the Midwest, it was not nearly as easy to keep kosher as it was in the Eastern Seaboard
congregation. It's not so prominent.
It was kosher. Yeah. It was not easy, but it was possible. And it's a choice people make to decide, well, I'm not going to
do it. This was very fragrant. I know.
Yeah, yes.
Fragrant.
Okay. So now the Union of American Hebrew Congregations was at first not a denominational body, as HUC was not supposed to be. But as time passed, over the next decade or so, it became clear that these were reform institutions, that they were not union in the sense of all of American Jewry, but rather they're a subset of American Jewry, the ones that can deal with and can tolerate the radical departures from tradition. Okay, Paul's asking, before you please repeat the name of the book you mentioned about the synagogues in New York City. So it's Moses Rishon, A Promised City, A Promised City. We have just a minute or two left. I want to cover a few more points. One other organization that Wise was able to develop was the Central Conference of American Rabbis, a rabbinical union, which was established among his graduates in 1889. So now he has synagogues, school, and a rabbinical union, all three, the trifecta. And the rabbis are all his disciples. So they revere him and regard him as like the Gadol Hador, the Posek Hador. Later on, it would become a catch-all for other Reform rabbis who were not disciples of his and did not graduate HUC, but who had come from Europe or who came from other schools. These are all his Talmidim. By the way, who went to HUC? What kind of a kid is sent as a teenager, as a young adult, off to Cincinnati to become a rabbi? You know, in 1870s or 1880s America, who wants to become a rabbi? Any idea?
Good question. No.
So if you're the son of a rabbi, so sometimes it's a family business. But let's say you're not the son of a rabbi. The answer is that people wanted to be rich and people wanted to be socially elite. Well, you can do that by getting into business and being successful. But not everyone is successful. And if you came from a poor family, from the frontier country, from west of the Appalachians, or west of the Allegheny, what did you have going for you? Your parents might say, let's send him off to Cincinnati. He'll become a rabbi. At least if he becomes a rabbi, he'll have dignity. He'll have certain social status and standing in the community. The people will respect him. All right, that's a good thing. Being a rabbi in 1880s, 1890s America, a reform rabbi, there was a certain kavod, a dignity that didn't exist previously. Okay, so that's who his target audience was. One last point for tonight.
And you could turn out to be a wise, though.
That's true. So one last point for tonight. There are two books in the study of American Jewish history that really cover the religious affairs of the 19th century. One was Leon Jick's book, Americanization of the Synagogue, that I mentioned a lot tonight. But the other was Moshe Davis's The Emergence of Conservative Judaism, which tells the story of the historical school in 19th century America. Whereas Jick ignores or basically poo-poos the significance of the moderate wing of American Jewish life, meaning the non-radicals. So we're talking about Benjamin Zold, Sabato Moraes, or Marcus Jastrow. So where Moshe Davis says, no, this is a school that's coalescing, and eventually in 1886 we'll establish the JTS in New York. And that the historical school in America is the forerunner of conservative Judaism. Conservative Judaism is not simply a sociological product that Marshall Sklar claimed it was in the 1950s, but rather it has antecedents, ideological antecedents, going back 150 years. Well, who's right and who's wrong? Is Moshe Davis right that there really was a precursor to conservative Judaism in 19th century America? Or is Jick... No. And basically, everybody who wasn't Orthodox, which was everybody, is really just a reformer at heart, but of varying degrees of moderate versus extreme. So I'm not here to say, to be machria, to decide which of the great scholars of the field is right and which one is wrong, but I'll tell you one thing. It's obvious that their training led them in different directions. Moshe Davis was a conservative rabbi. He graduated from JTS and got his PhD from Hebrew University. So he wanted to say that conservative Judaism had antecedents in the 19th century. Leon Jick was a Reform rabbi and a professor at Brandeis, got his PhD from Columbia. So he wanted to say, no, everybody really was Reform. It's just a question of more or less. Now, does this matter at all? No, it doesn't matter. It's just terminology that we throw around for fun. The point is that American Jewry was moving away from the tradition. So we'll stop here. Next time, we'll discuss at some length the arrival of Eastern European Jews before the Great Wave of 1881 and then into the Great Wave of 1881 and how that affects the community and how it affects American Judaism. So stay tuned for next week. All right, guys.
Thank you very much. That was very interesting.
Thank you.